opening of this brilliant new museum. We have a great lineup for you this evening. We hope you really enjoy the entire evening and stay until 3 a.m. And now I would love to introduce to you Dan Schifrin. He's the writer in residence and director of public programs at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. Please help me welcome Dan Schifrin.
Good evening. Jonathan Safran Foer, in his best-selling novels Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, has done as much as any contemporary writer to show how history is never past and that the social forces that shape and surround us are as powerful and sometimes as hateful as they have ever been. But he has made this argument with a voice so unusual and so seriously comic that we are compelled to believe in the power of imagination to help remedy the world's ills. No one can read Everything is Illuminated and feel the same way about the Holocaust, just as no one can read Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close and feel the same way about 9/11. Safran Foer's attention to language and moral responsibility recalls the holiday that inspired tonight's party. Shavuot begins tomorrow night, and the story we read, the biblical book of Ruth, which concerns the nature of selflessness and commitment to family, is one of stunning literary and ethical beauty. This biblical story, as well as Jonathan Safran Foer's novels, reminds us that storytelling, especially in the service of social transformation, is the backbone of Jewish culture and history. Jonathan Safran Foer's commitment to social responsibility has extended to the genre of nonfiction. His forthcoming book will be a series of reflections on the ecological and moral assumptions of our system of producing food, especially meat. What might it mean, I would be curious to know, that the wheat fields from the Book of Ruth, in which the poor are provided enough to live on, must share a spiritual ecology with the slaughterhouses, including the kosher slaughterhouses, which killed not just the animals, but the spirit of its workers. Jonathan Safran Foer is also the editor of a best-selling anthology of writing inspired by the bird boxes of Joseph Cornell, The Convergence of Birds. His libretto, Seven Attempted Escapes from Silence, was performed by the Berlin State Opera. His writings have been translated into 35 languages. I'd like to give a shout out to my colleagues at Reboot, in the forefront of reimagining Jewish life for this generation, who were able to convince Jonathan Safran Foer that this was a party he couldn't refuse. Jonathan Safran Foer's conversationalist tonight is Oscar Villalon, the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle Book Review and our local champion of the importance of literature in the public sphere. Oscar Villalon is also on the board of the National Book Critics Circle, whom he brought to San Francisco this year for the first time to announce the winners and finalists for their prestigious awards. He also reviews books for KQED's radio program, The California Report, and his work has been published in the Virginia Quarterly Review. I've been delighted to be Oscar's colleague on the selection committee for San Francisco's One City, One Book program, one of many civic programs he is devoted to, and have seen firsthand not just his knowledge and commitment to literature, but his encyclopedic knowledge of pro football. The format for tonight's conversation is a conversation with enough time available afterwards for the audience to ask questions. And please welcome Jonathan Safran Foer and Oscar Villalon.
Thank you very much.
The most important thing, I'm so sorry. Please turn off your cell phones. Thank you.
It's a sign of things to come. Thank you, Dan. First of all, thank you very much, everyone, for coming out tonight. This is a very impressive turnout in a very big room. And also, welcome to Mr. Foer. Yes. Given the many themes of your books and the ideas you've discussed in past interviews, there's no shortage of topics we can touch upon tonight. But I want to start the conversation in the spirit of the evening, which is with Shavuot in mind, and how that ties into the story of Ruth, but more important, a concept that figures prominently in the story of Ruth that I'm very intrigued by, and I want to pick your brain about, if that's okay. Okay. Take a deep drink. In the story of Ruth, Ruth's decision to stay by her mother-in-law's side is considered a model of chesed. That is, it's a loving kindness. It's a show of loyalty and commitment that go beyond the bounds of law or duty. And in your work, I see something similar. Specifically in the first novel, Everything is Illuminated, it seems that these sort of similar acts of loving kindness and fidelity play a major part in the story. Would you agree?
I guess I would. It's funny because as a writer, nobody quite believes me whenever I say this, but as a writer, I don't really think about things. You know, when I before I write, it's not as if I have all of these ideas that I then struggle to express. It's
right.
Not like that at all. And after I've written a book, it's not as if I'm left with all of these ideas that I'm now encountering. It's only when somebody asks me a question like that that it would even necessarily dawn on me to think of it in those terms. Writing is not, for me, intellectual. It's much more visceral or almost like fetishistic. You know, it's like some people like fur, some people like rubber.
Yeah.
And I like the things that I make.
Right.
I mean, it's not to say that I like them even as literature exactly. It's like, you know, people walk around with different kinds of itches, and you find different fingers in the world to scratch them. And like my writing are fingers for these itches that I have.
Okay.
And, you know, after the fact, of course, I could talk to you about, well, why might I have those particular itches? Well, they have something to do with how I grew up and what my family was like and what my family's history was like. But I have to say that's not what I was thinking when I wrote. It was much more physical. But in terms of kindness, it's a really interesting thing you asked me about because I feel like I've been wrestling with it a lot recently because I think you're right. I think my first book is filled with a lot of kindness and a kind of sweetness almost, maybe to a fault. And
to a fault? What do you think to a fault?
Well, it's to a fault if only because it's not what I would write now. You know, now, I mean, I think when you're very, very young and when you're starting out, you long for connections to other people more than you do as you get older and become more content with whatever world that you have, whether it's your interior world or, you know, at a certain point you say, I don't need to look for any more friends. I don't need to like flirt with more people. I don't need to even necessarily see more of the world. I mean, it's not say you don't want to, but you don't need to. You start to come to terms with the things that you have and also come to terms with gratefulness. I don't think young people understand gratefulness very well. I mean, I am a young person, but when I was younger. So when I started writing, I was very much interested in acquiring things in the world. I don't mean physical things.
As in like acquiring experiences?
Just acquiring stuff. I wanted more life. I wanted to see more things. I wanted to know more people. I wanted to live in more places. I wanted to... Everything was about how I could bring more into me. And as I've gotten a little bit older and a little bit more experienced, life is much more about managing the things that I have and trying to take care of the things that I have. So when I was in this acquisitive period, like, you wear a certain face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you want to go out into the world and you want the world to respond to you, I think things like being charming, maybe, were more important than they are in my life now. Now, I don't really necessarily... I was...
So you turned off the charm.
Well, that's for you to decide. But I now when I write, I've noticed I find myself angry more often, and that's an emotion I never would have let into my writing before, because it just would have somehow stood in the way of something I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. Like, anger is a perfectly great emotion, and there are a lot of good ways to express it. But in writing, I was trying to, like, acquire the world. And anger can only be, I thought, an obstruction, you know, between yourself and the world. It, like, you know, when you get angry at somebody, they tend to turn off
right.
from you. But maybe turning people off can be every bit as productive as, you know, bringing people in. And so my thoughts about all of this have changed really dramatically.
Does this have to do with having a son now and being married, you know, these sort of things? Is that what it is?
I don't know. I don't have another life. You know, I don't know what it would be like if I didn't have a kid or if I wasn't married and I just found myself at this age otherwise, or if I hadn't written a book or if I hadn't published a book. I just don't know. Probably has something to do with it. Also, probably it has something to do with there being more to be angry about. You know, I think it's not a coincidence.
Expand on that.
It's not a coincidence that old people tend to get cranky and that young people tend to be so, like, optimistic and romantic.
Well, I used to think that old people get cranky because they see young people making the same mistakes over and over again. I thought, you know, as it
no,
felt like,
that's
you
not
know.
Why old people get cranky.
Well, I thought, because it's like they look at you and go, hey, do you think that's going to work for you?
No, right, old people get cranky.
Good luck with that.
No, they see people and they say, that is working for you, and that doesn't work for me. You know, like the uncles I had, you know, who would sit me down when I was in high school and give me speeches about, you know, don't be so picky about what girls you mess around with, because the world doesn't care. And one day you're going to find that people willing to fool around with you is an exceptional thing, and they're very unavailable. And it, like,
how old were your uncles when they were telling you this?
I actually have a lot of young uncles, but they weren't that old. But you know, they were too old to be taught. This is the same uncle, by the way, who took me to F.A.O. Schwartz in New York. I grew up in D.C.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this just this morning. And, you know, they used to, maybe they still do, have these poor, struggling actors dressed up as, like, nutcracker dolls, you know? And you come to the door and they say, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. So I'm walking in with my uncle. He's holding my hand. I'm maybe 6 years old. Thank you for coming. And my uncle says, I'm not coming. I'm just breathing hard. And I was like...
Is he married?
Yeah, he's married. He has kids, in fact.
Wow. maybe it is your family. Maybe it wasn't totally a byproduct of youth. But nonetheless, despite what you're saying, I think there really is. I think in your first two novels, there is a sort of, shall we say, an idea, even if it wasn't conscious on your part, there is a sort of, or if you will, an ethos that compassion and that kindness are a necessary thing. And that, you know, again, tying it to the sort of concept of chesed, but that that these things are necessary for life. For example, when everything is illuminated, the relationship between Yinkle and Broad, there is definitely a sense there of commitment that goes, you know, beyond the scope. I mean, it's not even his kid, right? And he's taking care of him, and they have this bond. In fact, if I can trouble you, right here, if you wouldn't mind reading a passage from the book. These couple of paragraphs, I think.
It's traditional to warn somebody about this.
No, not at all. It's in Spanish.
I haven't even looked at this since, God, I don't know.
You can't edit while you read, by the way. That's...
Well, only I know if I'm editing while I read. So I don't even know what you want me to do. Read from
here. Exactly.
All right. Well, we'll read some of it anyway.
Okay.
But my very great and lonely grandmother, it's been a long time, didn't love Yankel, not in the simple and impossible sense of the word. In reality, she hardly knew him, and he hardly knew her. They knew intimately the aspects of themselves and the other, but never the other. Could Yankel have guessed what Broad dreamed of? Could Broad have guessed, could she have cared to guess where Yankel traveled at night? They were strangers, like my grandmother and me, but each was the closest thing to a deserving recipient of love that the other would find, so they gave each other all of it. He scraped his knee and said, I too have fallen. She spilled water on her pants so he wouldn't feel alone. He gave her that bead, she wore it, and when Yankel said he would die for Broad, he certainly meant it, but the thing he would die for wasn't Broad exactly, but his love for her. And when she said, Father, I love you, she was neither naive nor dishonest, but the opposite. She was wise and truthful enough to lie. They reciprocated the great and saving lie that our love for things is greater than our love for things, willfully playing the parts they wrote for themselves, willfully creating and believing fictions necessary for life.
Very good. In that passage, I think there's an implication of something, again, tying it sort of to the story of Ruth, this idea that when you go out of your way to show this devotion to someone, it's not, and tell me whether you agree with this or not, it's not just a question of saving that other person, but by doing that in some way, you're saving yourself.
I don't know. I mean, I know that people desire companionship so much that they fool themselves into thinking, they don't even fool themselves, they agree to be with the wrong person because it's that important, you know. Like the means justifying the end. And in a way, that's what all fiction is, right? I mean, fiction is a lie. It's not a real thing. These characters don't exist. But I commit 3 years to writing them.
Right.
And, you know, a reader, when he or she picks up a book, commits a certain number of days of his or her real life with these fictional things because we're so enamored of our being enamored. Like, we so like having those feelings that this is the extreme example. It doesn't even matter if they're not referring to things in the world, to real things. And so I think, you know, it's funny. I did a reading at a high school not that long ago, just last week, in fact. And one of the high school students, you know, high school students really tell you what they think. And one of them said, I find it surprising meeting you because I found your books very funny, but you don't seem very funny yourself. And I said, well, that's because you like the idea of me and not the me of me. And, you know, authors are different than writers. Writers are the people who actually sit there and put the words on the page. Authors are the people that we all imagine when we read a book. And authors are better than writers, just like books are better than manuscripts. You know, once a book goes out into the world and people start reading them, it, like,
has a life of its own.
It becomes an idea. Yeah. It's no longer attached or it's no longer constrained by just the words on the page. So I think that's what we all end up doing, you know, in life with our friends or with our, I hate the word lovers, but whatever's,
your hookups.
Yeah. And that's a fine, like, survival mechanism, but it's also obviously a very sad thing because at a certain point you find yourself, like, aware of the distance, you know, between what it is that you want and what it is that you actually have.
That seems kind of unavoidable. I mean, are you ever really going to close that distance? I suppose in any given life, you're never going to quite get those things. And then there's the other trouble of distinguishing between what you want and what you need.
Anyway, these are problems.
Yes, they are. Moving on. Let's talk about, I want to bring this up because also in light of kindness and this sort of thing, about activism as a vegetarian, if I could phrase it that way.
It's not how I would phrase it, but.
Well, how would you phrase it?
I don't feel like I'm an, you know, do you feel that you are activist or political as a Democrat? I know you're a Democrat, or I presume you are from our conversation backstage. I'm breaking all rules of journalistic ethics right now, right?
Probably not.
Okay.
I don't think there
it's
are any
not
left.
Your identification with the party.
Yeah.
It's that you have a certain set of values, and
right.
like your values sometimes, often more closely align with the party. So.
Well, I say it because I haven't done a video for Obama, but you did that short, I guess you could call it short documentary or short piece, If This Is Kosher.
Yeah.
That's why I phrase it that way.
Well, I do care about, that is like one set of issues that I care about, but I don't come to them as a vegetarian.
Okay.
I come to them as a person who cares about the environment, a person who cares about animal welfare. I come to them like anybody else in this room. There's nobody in this room who doesn't share the mm-hmm. values that I have when approaching this issue. It's just that I've chosen it as one that I care about. There are a lot of issues in the world. I don't necessarily, I don't do anything for other things that I care a lot about that other people do. So, in part, the reason I feel like careful about the terminology mm-hmm. is I'm writing a book now about this. I'm just about done. It's a nonfiction book. And it doesn't advocate vegetarianism. That really isn't the point. The point is to say, like, what are these values that we all really do seem to share? And it's shown out in polls very, very dramatically. And yet is so out of sync with our behavior, so antithetical to the ways that we spend our money, the things that we put in us are so unlike the ways that we envision ourselves.
Why do you think that is?
Why is that? Why did we have slaves for so long? Why did women not vote for so long? Why did World War II happen? Why does anything happen?
I mean, failure of empathy,
but also the power of tradition, the power of culture. You know, what did your parents eat? What did your grandparents eat? What have people been eating for millions of years? You know, these things are very hard to correct, even when we know. We might know that we want to correct them.
I read for this book, you've been traveling across the country, visiting animal farms. Is that correct? And you did this in 2006. Is that right?
Something like that.
And now, you're planning for this to come out as nonfiction. The reason I ask is because I remember looking back, preparing for this interview, seeing the interviews you gave. For Everything Is Illuminated, and you set out originally with no novel in mind with that, and it got, I guess, an approach which you might call a nonfiction approach, and wound up with a novel. Any likelihood of that happening with this particular project?
It would really ruin my life if it changed dramatically now, because I'm just dying. I mean, I've been with it for a long time, and I think I'm done basically. So that. If I were to wake up one morning with a eureka moment,
mm-hmm.
it would be like, it would really be terrible.
You're not funny.
Dark. You're funnier backstage yourself.
Dark. Well, I was drinking back there.
Water.
Yes, water. Clear, odorless water. For the video though, if this is kosher, what has been the reaction for that from that?
I don't know. I mean, reaction is always a self. People don't come up to you at readings often and mm-hmm. say, "Fuck you! I hated your book. It's a piece of shit." Like,
yeah.
Why would they waste their night coming to a reading or coming up to get a no book sign? I mean,
right.
So typically the reactions you get are positive.
Right.
In this specific case, I've also noticed there have been some. So basically, the video you're referring to is there's the largest kosher slaughterhouse in the world. Is it just an awful place? And
where's this located, by the way?
In Postville, Ohio.
Okay.
Iowa.
this will be important
Obama,
for the book.
Clinton, yeah. And it was just. A lot of people grew up. I did not come from a kosher home, but I came. We did. I mean, kosher is a spectrum. I suppose we were at one far end of the spectrum of kosher. Like we didn't eat pork, but we didn't have two sets of plates or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it was ingrained in me from since I started learning lessons, I knew that there's something to be proud of in being kosher, and that a large component of that pride came from the knowledge that these laws had something to do with making sure that animals didn't suffer unnecessarily, that, you know, you don't eat the kid in the mother's milk, all of this business. And so when I started thinking about it and thinking about the slaughterhouse and comparing the realities to the lessons that I learned, I thought, this is very frustrating to me, and I bet it would be frustrating to a lot of people. And I think it has been.
All right. Something else I want to ask you, actually. When you're thinking about the difference between writers and authors, at one point early, very early, when your book first came out, you said something that you didn't consider yourself a writer because writers had a wide body of work, and they'd gone through different phases in terms of their careers and were durable, et cetera. So my question to you is, do you consider yourself a writer now, or do you still not?
Well, I mean, it would be a silly thing for me to say no. That would be silly.
But go ahead. If you
no, I mean, it's my profession. It seems to be what I do. But in a kind of deeper sense, it's like asking somebody who loves to travel if he thinks of himself as a passenger of airplanes. Like, it's sort of true. Like, in order to travel, you have to take airplanes. But it doesn't really get to the heart of the question or the heart of the thing that you're interested in. And for me, I mean, it seems anecdotally to me like writers either grew up reading tons of books, keeping diaries, always knowing that they wanted to be writers, or, like me, just sort of coming to it through a back door. Not really. I didn't read a whole lot when I was a kid. I never wrote. I don't think I wrote a story until I was in college. And just starting to get a sense not only of how much writing had to offer and how open it was, but how little the rest of the world seemed to offer to me in terms of jobs I might have.
So it seemed like basically this is something I could do.
It's something that I can do, but it's something that can contain everything else.
Okay.
It's sort of like Halloween, where you get to choose. You know, a lot of kids on Halloween dress up as the things they always wanted to be. Like, the girls in my high school would dress up as princesses because, like, they kind of looked pretty, and it was, like, all the stuff they sort of secretly wanted to wear, and the boys would dress up as, like, pop stars, kind of making fun of it and thinking it was kitschy, but secretly liking the way that, like, overalls with no t-shirt underneath, that kind of stuff. And
what about the kids that dressed up like bums? Remember those?
Well,
yeah, what was that all about then?
We didn't have those where I grew up, I guess.
We had them where I grew up. We had.
So writing has a way of, like, just the other day I was reading an interview with Olafur Eliasson, who I know his show was at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and he was describing all of the different projects he worked on, and my first response was, ah, that's what I should have done. I should have been an artist, like a visual artist, and all of the. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, I can actually write a character who has all of these ideas. And in fact, with Olafur Eliasson, I think the description of the ideas are really pretty much every bit as good as seeing the things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a little, I have to admit, I was gravely disappointed in that show. But because I went home and, you know, a friend was like, where'd you go? I went to Olafur Eliasson. What was it like? What was it like? I'll tell you exactly what it was like. I told him, and then I said, don't even bother going. I just told you exactly what it was like. So there's a way that as a writer, you can, you're just so free. You know, you're free, you're so unconstrained in a way that nothing else that I've ever encountered makes you unconstrained.
Well, I suppose it gives you a license to explore life.
Not only to explore life, but to do it with, like, words that are just this big on a page.
Well, conversely, I mean, among people who become journalists, one of the appeals of journalism is that it essentially gets you to places and meet people you otherwise wouldn't be able to meet. I mean, you know, your beat becomes whatever you want it to do. Do you want to write about science? You can write about science. You get bored with that, you can write about politics. You can do this sort of thing. So, I mean, I understand where you're coming from. I understand that sort of idea to maybe not so much to reinvent yourself, but as you do reinvent yourself, you have a channel in which to express what's going on.
I don't think I described it quite right, because that didn't sound like what I meant.
Okay.
I think part of what I mean is that I don't want to be anybody. It's not that I want to be a visual artist or this. Mm. I just don't want to be anybody. I don't want to have, you know, what a horrible name drop, but Nietzsche said that everything that we've given words to is already dead to us. And like, I had that feeling when I was in college and I was having to think about what might I be? What kind of a life might I have? Like, where in the dictionary of all the people who have ever lived would I find myself? And I didn't want to be in that dictionary. I didn't want that constraint. And I think the thing that I've fallen in love with as a writer is how unconstrained it allows you to be. And I don't just mean because one day you can write like you're a doctor and one day you can write like you're a physicist. Mm-hmm. That's not what I mean at all. I mean that you can kind of be nobody. You can just, it's like in the way that a wave going through an ocean, mm-hmm. you know, the water itself doesn't travel. It's just the energy that travels through. And as a writer, you don't put yourself in different personas. You can just be a kind of energy that moves through a book. And that's something that I've just been, that I really like.
When you talk with other writers, do they express the same sort of ideas about what they're doing?
You know, I really only talk with one other writer who I'm married to. I don't talk with other writers about writing. I just don't.
And your wife, what does she say?
We don't talk about writing that much, truth be told. I mean, do you know the old joke about the gynecologist who comes home one day, and this is probably a misogynistic joke already because I'm assuming it's a man, but mm-hmm. this male gynecologist comes home one day, and his wife is in bed, and the lights are low, and there's candles all around, and a bottle of wine on the table, she's wearing lingerie, and she pats the bed, you know, beside her, and he says, "If I have to see another one of those things, I'm going to fucking kill myself." And my relationship at home with regards to writing, is sort of like that. Like, I work all morning. That's what I do. And I just don't want to talk about it when I come home. Maybe it's because I came to writing through that back door, you know? And now I might be mixing metaphors. But it's like not the end all for me. It's not that it's what I do. It's the vent. It's the vehicle. But it's not the end all. I don't need to think about it all day long. So when I'm done with my work, I come home and I think about other things and I do other things.
You would have gone crazy in an MFA program.
I don't know what that means.
There you go. See, that doesn't even compute. I mean, if you had gone to,
I would have gone crazy.
I mean. I think you would have just lost your mind.
Well, we'll never know.
No, I know. I'm pretty certain of that. That's when you're having the late night discussions and everyone's talking, and believe me, trust me, they would have been like, "Oh man, who is that dude? He doesn't even want to be anybody. I don't know." All right, well, we're gonna end it with that for this part, and now we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. Is there okay?
Yeah. Excuse me. Hi, Oscar.
Yes.
Just a moment. I have a quick announcement, ladies and gentlemen, before Molly and I come around with the microphones. If you have any questions, we will come around with the mic. But when the Q&A session is finished here, we do have to clear the room entirely before people come back in for dengue fever. So if you are here for dengue fever, I just want you to know that you're going to have to leave the room and get in line. Okay? So I don't want anyone to be really disappointed. And one other thing to note is for those of you in the back, if you have any questions, if we could ask that you come to just before the mic, the speakers here, because the microphones don't work past those speakers. Yeah? Okay, Jeff tells me we can go wherever we want. Okay. All right.
How great would that announcement have been if you had not mentioned that Dengue Fever was a band? This place would have cleared out. All right. So I guess now we do the questions.
I think she has one right here. I'm sure we can hear you.
Yeah, go ahead.
No.
Sound pretty loud. Yeah, go.
Okay. I guess I'm the first one. Thank you so much.
actually, there's just one person here, and then you'll be the second one.
Please.
You You were talking about how writing are sort of the fingers that help you scratch the itch you need to scratch, and how part of that is informed by your family's experiences. I'm really interested in finding out about what you imagine and what you hope that the family that no longer exists, that branch that you never got to meet and connect with, how they would receive this book, and how the members of the family who are present, how they have received it.
Did everybody hear the question? Yeah? I've never thought about that. I have to say, I didn't. If I had thought about that, I'm sure I wouldn't have written the book. It's funny, there was, so Trachenbrod, this village in the book, it was a real place. And in fact, there was a reunion in D.C. about 2 months ago. There were about 150 people there, descendants. There were 5,700 people who lived in this village, and I think 23 survived. My grandfather's one of the 23. And now there are maybe 300, 400 descendants around the world, 500, something like that. And so, I mean, needless to say, my book was like a big thing for the Trachenbrod Society, right? And so I got to, in a certain way, I experienced the answer to your question. Not quite literally, but I think it was mixed. I mean, it's funny. Maybe the best way to answer it is like this. My grandmother, who is the only survivor of the Holocaust in my family. I mean, my grandfather, in his own way, survived for a while, but my grandmother did survive fully. And she didn't even know I went to Eastern Europe until an excerpt of the book was published in The New Yorker. And I just couldn't talk to her about it. I mean, anybody here who's from a Jewish family probably understands why that would be the case. And so finally, she read this piece, and then we talked on the phone, and I was really nervous because I was going to get an answer to your question. And she said, oh, I wanted to tell you I really liked your story. And I was like, great, wow, thanks, oh, that's so nice. And she said, it's not what I would have chosen to write. And I thought that was such a really great thing for her to say, because it reminded me of really like the point of literature, which is we have ways that we choose to tell things, and those ways don't correspond to the circumstances of our lives. So when I wrote the book, if I had had to imagine, and I didn't, but if I had tried to imagine who would have liked such a book, I would have imagined myself, like a young Jewish person on the East Coast with glasses. Like, that's what I would have imagined. As it turns out, like, some of the strongest negative reactions I got were from people who were most circumstantially similar to me, and some of the strongest positive reactions were from people who were most circumstantially unlike me. James Baldwin said that, you know, he used to think that the things that he felt most deeply, like when he was most depressed or when he was most happy, were the things that disconnected him from the world, because nobody could ever be depressed like he was depressed or be happy like he was happy. And then when he encountered literature, he found that it was just the opposite, that those were the things that connected him most strongly to other people, and that those connections can span very far, you know, geographical or temporal distances. Like, why? I don't know why that was a surprise to me when some of my favorite books were written hundreds of years ago or in different languages or by authors halfway around the world. So, you know, the shame is that, as was mentioned in the introduction, this book, Everything is Illuminated, has been translated now into, I think, about 35 languages. And my grandmother really only speaks Yiddish fluently. And that, of course, is not a language of those 35. So if there were a person on earth that I had been writing the book for, it would have been her. And she can't really read it in any straightforward way. But I mean, if there were a central theme to the book, that's probably it as well, like the impossibility of communicating directly or effectively.
Okay, my question is also about Track and Broad. I was fascinated by all the Track and Broad bits and Everything is Illuminated, maybe because my father comes from the nearby city of Rovno, so I felt kind of at home. But I wonder about the way you constructed Track and Broad in the book as an imaginary place, whether you researched or totally imagined it, because sometimes it felt like an unlikely hybrid or a fantastic hybrid between a shtetl and a Midwestern town with its pumpkin festival. So I wondered how you came up with this very special imaginary place.
Well, I think that's a pretty good description, actually. I mean, it's clearly not accurate. And I hope it's clear I wasn't aspiring for that kind of accuracy. I mean, there are all kinds of anachronisms and just weird things that are wrong throughout. There's a single piece of research that I did, and it is the first sentence of the Track and Broad history, which is, it was on March 17th, I know that because it's my mom's birthday, 1791, the year my mother was born, when Chocham K's double axle wagon either did or did not flip and sink and blah, 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 blah. So I actually did acquire a whole bunch of documents, historical documents about this shtetl. And in fact, it was named, or so we think, for this person, who drowned in the Broad River. There was no did or didn't in the history, it is assumed. And so when I started writing the book, and as Oscar said, I didn't really know what kind of book I was writing, I came across that fact, and I thought, this is a really good first sentence. You know, is on this date that this person drowned in the river? I thought, that's really virile, and it's just good. And then
it's a manly sentence.
Yeah. And then I thought, well, it's not really me, though. I mean, there are probably better ways of doing it. You know, what if he escaped? That would be really great. Or what if we didn't know if he in fact sunk or escaped? And what if instead of, you know, the exclamation point of that great strong first sentence, by the way, every time you hear somebody say that's a great first sentence, it's almost always a terrible first sentence, because it's a sentence that draws all of this attention to itself, like, the still beating heart in my shivering hands told me I had to drive faster. You know, things like that. Like, in an MFA program, people are like, damn it, that's good. I need to read more. But in fact, it's not good at all, because you're just like, damn it, that's good. And the whole point of writing is just to be invisible.
Right.
So in any case, I had a long internal debate about, do I write this sentence as history has it or as my imagination has it? Because there are real consequences. You know, each choice has very, very serious consequences, particularly because of the story that I was telling. You know, is this the one story that you're not allowed to mess around with or have fun with or insert anachronisms into? And I just wasn't sure. And so it took a lot of backing and forthing until ultimately I decided, I don't care if it's a good book. My reason for writing it isn't to make a good book. It's something else. It's to create this great finger, you know, for this great itch. And it had to be that way in order for me to do it. And then everything, the entire rest of the book followed from that decision, from choosing not to obey history in that sense, like a biographical history or journalistic history, and instead siding with something more experiential.
Gentlemen, we have a question down here to your left.
Jonathan, I just wanted to thank you so much for the book. I was so inspired that I took it upon myself to go to the Western Ukraine and visit the villages of my ancestors and had experiences of my own that were quite meaningful. And I had to stop and ask myself why I was there, and then I realized it was because of your book and the film. Thank you.
Thank you. I would have urged you not to go if you had asked me. It's such a very, very hard place to go to, isn't it?
It is.
In every sense.
Uh, I'm just wondering, why isn't the book
Where is the person who's asking the question?
I'm right here. Oh. Why isn't the book in Yiddish?
Why isn't it in Yiddish? How many people do you know that would buy a book in Yiddish? I mean, somebody has to translate it, somebody has to publish it. It's just a very big ordeal. At a certain point, the Forward in New York had talked to me about commissioning a translation. And it went the way of other Jewish dreams, I guess.
Another question?
Right up there, Molly, can you?
I was wondering if you were happy with the movie version of your book. And it was completely wonderful, I thought. And it's one of my favorite movies. And I don't know, I know that they get distorted sometimes in the movies, and they don't really follow the writer's idea as much. Is it true to what you wrote, you thought, the representation?
I think objectively it's not true to what I wrote. I mean, I don't even think that's a matter of opinion. Like, literally half the book isn't in the movie. Mm-hmm. Was I terribly upset about it? Not really. I mean, there's the dirtiest saying that I know has to do with complaining the morning after you have intercourse with a certain barnyard animal that a certain part of your anatomy smells a certain way. Like, I knew what I was getting into, and...
Was it really like that?
What's that?
Was it really like that?
No, I mean, it's like, how could I sit up here and say,
well, if you're going to make it into a movie, I guess so.
No, I mean, how could I sit up here and say, oh, I had no idea, what did they do? Yeah. Like, it's just a different thing. And also, I have to say, movies are, you know, one of the saving graces of literature is that literature will never compete with movies. Like, it will never be as big. It will never sell as well. It will never be as culturally important. And so there will also never be a conference room filled with people making decisions about how your novel should end. You know, they will never audience test excerpts from a novel. You have freedom because of that. And I feel sorry. I mean, the guy who made the book is a very, very smart guy. And I think, like, went at it with perfect intentions. But it's hard to make a movie because there's so many people
components.
Worried about ambiguity and nuance that... Well, movies are passive and novels are active. When I was saying the thing about how small words are, mm-hmm. when I was talking about that being like the liberating aspect of writing, what I meant is when you see a tree in that movie, you see the same tree that everybody sees. We're all seeing the same tree and we would agree on almost all of the details about it. But if I write the word tree in my book, like you have a little tree over your head and the person sitting next to you has a tree over her head, and those trees are maybe like the tree you passed when you were growing up on your way to school or the tree in your backyard now, and they, like, your mental images are informed by all of your experiences, and it becomes something that's very open and very, very big.
That's it's funny, that's exactly the same thing Paul Auster says about writing, that when you write these sort of sentences, you know, people automatically will have an image of a base like that that's going to be so much more powerful and more vivid than, you know, giving them one concrete type, you know, type of looking tree or et cetera like that.
I think it's why Peanuts was such a successful cartoon. You know, it's so open. Like, the faces are just a circle, a squiggle, two dots, and that's it. Like, you couldn't conceivably draw less and still have a face. And because of that, they become open to you and accessible. Like, a book should be like an invitation, not a party. And there are plenty of perfect books written. There are plenty of brilliant authors. Like, someone like an Ian McEwan, maybe, mm-hmm. writes books that are pretty much perfect. Like, you read them and you say, oh, I don't know how that could be better. And you close it and you put it on the shelf. And you don't, I, for one, don't really think about them again. And then there are authors, maybe like Philip Roth, who write books that are very imperfect and can be extremely frustrating. But they're also open. They engage you. Like, you can't help but argue with them or participate in their creation. And you know that when you finish the last word of one of his good books, like, the reading experience is not over, because he's made you complicit. And so it takes a very, very, very unusually good movie to make a viewer complicit. But in writing, you know, this book ends with a sentence that's interrupted, an incomplete sentence. And in a way, again, I wasn't thinking this at the time, but when I think back on why I might have done that, I think it has to do with this, like wanting it to be an extended hand, you know? I wasn't waiting for applause. That's not the point. It's like one hand that's extended for a hand from a reader, that like this has to be something that continues. Otherwise, it's insignificant. Otherwise, it's just entertainment. It's like another episode of Grey's Anatomy. Like, it's good, it's fine, the world loves it. The world probably even needs more of it, but there is something more to aspire to.
I think we have time for one more question. Where's that microphone floating around? Anyone? You don't have to ask. No?
There's somebody right here or here.
Oh, someone else. I was just wondering, I don't know, I haven't seen all your interviews, so I'm not sure, but maybe this has already been answered. What was it like for you to write a novel that had your first, middle, and last name, but maybe not exactly all those events happened to you? What was it like to put your name in that?
Something I didn't think through fully at the time. I always had it that way. I never had it any other way. And it's funny, I was on the plane ride here from New York, I was thinking, wouldn't it be good to write a novel in which I'm on a plane and this is, and it's like, get it out of your head. Why does it have to be you, you know? Think about, like, just do somebody else. So, of course, I do write about other people, but my first instinct is always imagining myself doing something or somewhere. I think that I did, actually, at this reading, at this high school that I was just mentioning, one of the students asked me or said, I keep a diary, and I love to keep a diary, and I think I'm very good at keeping a diary. But I was hoping you could give me some advice for how I could get into more serious kinds of writing. And I said to him, well, what do you mean by more serious? I mean, why do you think there's something more serious than a diary? I've tried keeping diaries throughout my life. I don't try very hard anymore because I've realized I stink at it. Like whenever I write, you know, today I took a plane, today I did this, today I did that, it smelled like this, oh, this bad thing happened. It never sounds like myself, and I feel totally inauthentic, and I read it, and it's just bullshit, and I feel miserable. It's like the most, a failed diary is like the most depressing object in the world. I'm serious. It reflects on you so badly because it makes your life seem terrible. It makes your like abilities to express yourself feel terrible. Everything about it is bad. When I started writing fiction, I found that when I wrote in other people's voices, I did sometimes sound like myself. And strangely, sometimes the further I threw my voice, the more it sounded like me. Like if I wrote as an 80-year-old man or a 9-year-old boy or a Ukrainian, obviously the circumstances were totally different, but like the thing that was coming through felt so familiar and felt so authentic. In a way, this comes back to the thing that James Baldwin said, that ultimately what we're talking about in literature is not like skin color or religion or socioeconomic background or nationality or when you were born or when you died or gender, even though all of those things like are indispensable and it's impossible not to think about them and talk about them. But like we're talking about just something else, something that's beneath all of that. So when I wrote my first book, I didn't understand exactly. I still don't understand, but I understood less well how to negotiate all of these different levels of things that were happening. Like on the one hand, I was kind of writing a diary. And on the other hand, I was just kind of telling a story. And the book itself, I think, like the conflict of the book is not what's going to happen when they do or don't find this woman. What's going to happen to this grandfather when he, you know, makes his escape from this doomed village. The conflict of the book is what's going to happen when the imagination has to confront reality. Like one half of the book is so fanciful and so sort of magically realistic or fairy tale-like or mythical, and one half of it really is colder or is at least more, you know, present tense and linear. And ultimately, these things have to meet. And it's not a conflict that I made up because I thought it was interesting. It's the conflict that I live every single day when I write. Like, I spend my time writing stories when I'm a decently, you know, able person. Like, if I devoted my life to feeding hungry people, less people would be hungry. Fewer people would be hungry. That's just a truth. And so somehow I have made this choice that writing stories is as important, is more important than that other thing I could be doing. So how do I make sense of that? Well, the book, in a way, tries to make sense of it. And I think naming the character, giving the character my name, was like walking along the fence between these two things. It was like the high wire act, you know, between imagination and reality.
All right. I guess on that note, then, we'll end the conversation. Jonathan Safran Foer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Safran Foer.
That's you.
Oscar, thank you so much, too, as well. Let's give a big hand for both of them, please. Okay, so we went a little over, so I'm supposed to be here to encourage you all to go and venture your way.